This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 104 was recorded on February 8th, 2018. I'm Eric Townsend. It's been a hell of a week, and we have a hell of a show lined up for you. Jared Dillon, author of the popular Daily Dirt Nap newsletter, will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest. We'll talk about the role that the short vol trade played in this week's equity sell-off, as well as what's ahead for stocks, the U.S. dollar, and much more. You already know that the volatility complex basically blew up earlier this week. And if you're a regular Macro Voices listener, you know that we've both predicted this event and covered it extensively on past shows. 2 weeks ago, Artemis Capital founder Chris Cole laid out exactly how this could go down in his feature interview, which, needless to say, was prescient. Chris will be back for an update in our post-game segment after the feature interview with Jared Dillon. Regular listeners may also remember Devin Anderson joining us in our postgame segment back on November 30th when he described exactly how the volatility complex could blow up on a really big one-day move in equities such as we had on Monday. Devin will also join us in today's postgame segment right after we get an update from Chris Cole. We'll revisit what happened and what's next for the vol complex. If you missed Devin's first appearance, you can find it in the post-game segment after our feature interview with Jonathan Tepper back in November. Just look for Jonathan's name and photo on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Chris Cole's interview is next to his photo on our homepage just 2 weeks back.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, that S&P 500 literally took a dive right after we finished last week's episode of Macro Voices and just started to roll over. We find ourselves near the 2600 level on the S&P right now as we're recording. What's your thinking now on the S&P at these levels?
Well, the first thing to put in context, Patrick, is so far we've seen, and even on an intraday basis, about a 10% total peak-to-trough sell-off. So, yeah, it's a big deal, but, you know, it's a correction. If we go back to normal times, excluding the recent few years of central bank-supplied liquidity, a 10% correction is really not a big deal. It's not out of the usual. It's not the end of the world. So, if we want to think in terms of has the market crashed, is the big event that some people have predicted happened now, it's definitely not this. It's not big enough yet. So the big question that's on everybody's mind is this the best buy the dip opportunity in years, or is this the beginning of a really big sell-off? Needless to say, the ratio call spread strategy that we've described and that you had a webinar on has paid off in spades. That allowed people who wanted to continue to have upside exposure to the stock market to close their long stock positions and to put an option trade on that had no downside. So people who got out of the stock market when we first recommended it and instead expressed their upside with that ratio call spread didn't lose a penny on this sell-off. The next question, of course, that we have to get to is, are we going to see a retrace all the way back up and make some new highs and the 10% correction is in that was long overdue and it's all uphill from here? Or is it going to just get worse from here? It's important to understand what happened in the first place. And frankly, I don't think anybody knows for sure. But one of the narratives that we're hearing is what I'm calling the tail wagging the dog scenario, which is to say higher interest rates are what got the equity sell-off started. But then it was the VIX blowing up. Basically, we got the VIX up to a point on natural selling in the stock market where it triggered that liquidation event we've been fearing for so long. And when that happened, VIX futures going up are a trigger because there are a lot of algorithmic trading systems that are programmed to start selling equities when the VIX goes up. So I think that a big piece of what has happened here is, in fact, that the VIX has exacerbated the sell-off. There was room to say after that first event, maybe that caused it to go too far and we're going to just recover, kind of flash crash style V recovery. What we're seeing today on Thursday afternoon is signs that that rally has failed. held at just more than a 50% retrace of the sell-off. We're not back to fresh new lows yet, but boy, we're getting close. And in fact, on a closing basis, intraday lows, we're not there yet. On a closing basis, it looks like Thursday's close, and we're taping this a few minutes as I'm speaking right now before the cash close at 4 p.m. on Thursday. It looks like we may be headed for a new closing low on Thursday. So it's not looking good for the recovery scenario. Now, does that mean that the end is nigh and the market is crashing from here? I doubt it. And if I had to pick an analogy to what this feels similar to, think about 1987, but not October 19th of 1987. Think a month or two before that, when we started to see significant increases in volatility in the stock market, but it wasn't over yet. It wasn't the big one. Now, you might say, well, those were smaller than a 10%er. We got 10%. Isn't this the big one? Who says the big one is going to be as small as it was in 87? I think the big one, when it happens, and I thought it was still at least 6 months off, maybe I'm wrong, but when the big one happens, I think it's a doozy, and I think it could be bigger than a 23% down move, which is what we saw in October of 87. I don't necessarily think that it started yet, but I think maybe we're getting closer to it. It's going to be very interesting in coming days to see whether or not we can get back up to, you know, further up the hill towards a recovery. So far, it's not looking good. If we sell off to new lows, you know, watch for it to accelerate, and think it's going to be very interesting. We're going to get all three of our guests to comment on where things may be headed from here. Meanwhile, Patrick, I want to come back to the various option strategies we've talked about. Needless to say, getting out of equities and expressing your long interest in the market using that ratio call spread that you did a webinar on was a fantastic call. People who did that didn't lose a penny in this sell-off. But you actually told me off the air, your big picture trading clients really made a huge windfall profit this week because you were calendaring straddles. And I know that strategy is of interest to our listeners. I want to touch on that. But particularly, you know, it's a different game now because a lot of what we've said in past weeks has been, hey, options have never, ever been cheaper. It's time to take advantage of that cheap optionality. That's a big different story right now. So give us an update on some of the option strategies that you're talking to your big picture trading clients about. And, you know, since the environment has changed, are you going to do another webinar to bring people up to date?
Well, Eric, it was really actually a great week for our members, and congratulations to all of them. One of the things we were doing, because we were opening all of these trades in that low vol period, one of the ways that I was expressing the trades was publishing a calendared straddle. Basically, we were buying a longer dated put option and hedging it with short-term calls, and we kept rolling it up. So every time we were early and the market took another leg higher, we kept closing the straddle for a profit and rolling it to the higher strike. And so we basically rolled up that straddle right up to the mid-280s on the SPY, and suddenly the market reversed and we were able to cash in a big way. But you know, the market has now completely changed, because now that the VIX has exploded out and the vol premiums returned right in, like, you're seeing options on the SPYs, right? The implieds are north of 30% on many of these options. And so right now, all of those strategies we talked about as ratio call spreads or ratio put spreads or straddles and things like that, while they were really good a couple weeks ago, they're really expensive now. And so you have to rethink the entire way to approach options trading in this environment, completely opposite of where we were earlier. And, you know, I was originally talking with you even potentially about doing another webinar, because during the last one, when we did the ratio call spreads, a lot of our listeners were making the comment, well, what about a ratio put spread? And we said, well, absolutely, you could do a ratio put spread. And I was thinking, well, you know what, we got to have another webinar to kind of talk about how to take advantage of the market to the downside. Well, it was kind of late. We were setting it all up and then the market started to dive. So we still are going to do a webinar this upcoming weekend. You can find the link in the Research Roundup email, or you could go to bigpicturetrading.com and register on there. We wanted to now flip it around, because now have this very high vol period. And there's one of two things that are going to happen. Either A, how do you keep expressing a downside trade? You think the market is going to keep going lower. Or more importantly, in this very high vol period, how do you call a bottom and use options to try to express the long side of the market and try to buy the dip while the volatility is so expensive? And so lots of really interesting things I look forward to actually discussing in that one. And that's going to be on Sunday at 11 a.m. and then another one on Monday Eastern time.
And I think the important thing for everybody to understand there is it's a different game. It's not time now to learn about the strategies we were espousing and recommending a few weeks ago. It's a different vol regime, and it's a different strategy, and that's probably why you're doing a new webinar. Let's move on, though, to keep things rolling, because we've got three guests lined up. U.S. dollar. I am leaning now. I know it sounds crazy, but I really think that the dollar recovering, I don't know if it's a new secular bull market, but more than just a bounce. A lot of people were thinking, yeah, we're getting a little bounce. It's the, you know, look for a chance to short it again here because it's headed down. Boy, I was coming around to that viewpoint, but, you know, if this was just a bounce, I can't reconcile it with what's going on with yields in gold. The only way I can reconcile the interactions between the different asset classes is if the dollar is perhaps bottoming here, at least in the short term. Now, if yields turned around, that would be another story. But as long as we see this trend toward increasing bond yields, I think the dollar has bottomed and is headed higher from here.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because we saw that short-term overhead resistance and now a couple of days of straight selling down towards the 60 handle on the downside. What's happening here in oil?
Well, finally, you know, I've been saying for how long now that I really think we're overdue, and particularly with regard to, you know, like 12 to 1 speculative long to short ratio, it was just a setup for a big sell-off, and it has begun. The big question is how far we go. Let's start with inventory, Patrick. We built on crude oil, building 1.9 million barrels. Cushing, Oklahoma, still drawing down, but a very small drawdown compared to what we've seen in recent weeks, 711,000 barrels. Probably the Brent spread narrowing is the reason that we're not seeing as many exports and we're not seeing as much pressure on Cushing. The reasons for that were described in our interview last week with Pat Hemsworth. Gasoline, great big build, 3.4 million barrels. Distillates building 4 million barrels. So big builds, needless to say, very bearish news. And production, another 332,000 barrels, all the way up to 10.251 million barrels. That's, I believe, an all-time record, even, you know, topping whatever it was in the early 70s when the U.S. was producing the most oil. And I'm pretty sure that we're now producing more oil in the United States than Saudi Arabia. Holy cow. So the big question is, that's needless to say, all very bearish news. How far does this go? Well, I can very easily, Patrick, make a strong argument for if you look at how extreme the speculative positioning was, everybody on one side of the boat, it was the same setup that we saw in the middle of 2014. It was a similar setup, but even more extreme than what we had in February of last year. It's time for the beginning of a multi-month sell-off that takes us way down, at least $10, maybe even $15 lower. The thing is, Patrick, I have been wrong a lot this year, thinking, okay, here comes a big sell-off. And actually, my timing's been pretty good on when the sell-offs were going to happen. I say we're going to go down $5 to $10, and we go down 50 cents to a dollar. Now, this time, we finally got our $5 down. But if I look at the chart, if this is just going to be a correction to the bottom of the established upward sloping channel that we see, then it's over right here. It's done. And we can expect it to recover and start to move to the upside. I am leaning not towards that case. I think that there is more selling and more downside to come in crude oil prices. But I have to handicap myself and say I have been bearish and wrong quite a few times. If we continue to see production numbers like this and inventory building instead of drawing, I think things are going to finally turn around. It's been a long time in coming, but it's finally happening. We'll see what happens.
All right, Eric, well, let's move on to gold because this moment the U.S. dollar reversed, gold just started to downtick and we're now heading down to around the 1317 area on bullion. What's your thinking here on gold?
Well, it's pretty clear, at least in this cycle, that you know we're headed back down. We're not going to take out 1,400. At this point, as far as where is it going in the next few weeks, how would you trade it? I don't really have an opinion. I'm not so interested in gold right now for trading it. I'm more interested in the macroeconomic signal that it's telling me. And the signal is this is not the catastrophic end of the world for the U.S. dollar because it was so hard to reconcile increasing treasury yields with weakening dollar. And that is a signal that I've predicted for a long time that would eventually come when it truly is the end game for the U.S. dollar's hegemony over the global financial system. If that was happening, we wouldn't talk about whether or not gold can get past 1,400. We'd be thinking about 14,000. So clearly, it's not that. And I think all things told, I do expect a big move up in gold at some point here. Eventually, we're going to get back to inflation. We're going to get to a very difficult situation where central banks' hands are tied. They can't really solve our problems by printing money. And I think that gold is going to see a really big run to the upside. But I'm leaning more and more towards that not being time yet, that we probably have a wave down in gold. How far, I don't really know. But I don't think it's time for gold to make its big move up yet.
Now let's move on to 10-year yields, because we had on Monday this quick, sharp reversal off of the 285 level, going all the way down to 270 on the yields. And we were asking whether that was the big reversal. And yet now, just 3 days later, we find ourselves right back to the 285 level. It doesn't seem like these bonds are letting up here. What's your thinking here on interest rates and bonds?
Well, of course, when you had the VIX complex blow up and that triggered the algos to start selling, people who are panic selling out of the stock market have got to put the money someplace. A lot of that goes into bonds. Sure enough, that created a short-term reversal in this trend. And a lot of people were saying, okay, that was a head fake up to the 280, whatever, and it's not going to come back. As soon as that flow out of the equity market into the bond market slowed down, we saw the trend turn right back around, and we're headed higher in yield, 285 this afternoon. So it seems like the Jeff Gundlachs and Bill Grosses of the world who have said, hey guys, the jig is up and rates are headed higher, are going to be right. The big question is, how far can it really go? At some point, you can't get back to historically normal treasury yields, I contend, because it would literally bankrupt the United States government if you did. I'm going to ask Jared Dillon about this, and I want to talk in more of our postgame segments and future shows about some different scenarios. But we've got to figure out what is going on in the bond market and how much farther it can go. I don't really have a strong opinion at this point other than to watch the trend. But if this continues, it's going to, I think, continue to create a lot of trouble for the stock market. I think probably the reason, and as I'm speaking right now, we're just hitting 4 o'clock, and it looks like it is going to be a new closing low today on Thursday in stocks. I think the 285 that we see in yields is a big part of the reason for that. If this continues, I think the stock market's in trouble, and boy, stock market and bond market selling off at the same time. Talk about the carnage that comes to the risk parity trade. That, of course, was part of Chris Cole's pyramid slide where he talked to us about all of the different forms of the short vol trade. I want to get Chris's update on that. So I'll stop talking now. We'll save time for our expert guests because we've got three of them lined up.
Now, Eric, Keith McCullough had you on Hedgeye as a guest to discuss Bitcoin. Why don't you quickly fill us in on what you did on the show?
I really enjoyed that. Keith is a good guy, and I like the Hedgeye guy. Very, very professional crowd to work with. Basically, I do have a lot of opinions on Bitcoin. I don't want to editorialize here on Macro Voices. We've got too much else to cover. Keith and I went, I think, a good solid half hour on a video interview. You can find a link to it in your research roundup email. It has all of my reservations, and it's kind of an outline of my debunking blockchain white paper, which was linked a couple of weeks ago. So let's leave it there and save time for our future guests.
That sounds good. I want to actually check that out. Now, let's move on to our featured interview guest, which is the Daily Dirt Naps author, Jared Dillon, who also writes for Malden Economics. Eric's interview with Jared is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me next on the program is Jared Dillon, the author of the extremely popular Daily Dirt Nap newsletter. Jared, obviously, everybody's mind is on the equity market this week, but I think it's really important to bring the volatility complex into this. As you know, your friend Devin Anderson appeared on this program back on November 30th, and he explained that a equity move the size of what happened on Monday could potentially blow up the volatility complex. But I think what a lot of people have started to talk about is it may have actually been the tail wagging the dog, that what exacerbated, or some people would even say caused, this equity sell-off may have been the vol complex blowing up. So it's a question of cause and effect. What do you think is going on here? Is it possible that vol caused the equity meltdown, or did the rate hike cause backing up in interest rates cause this to start? And how do you see the interplay between what's happened in equity markets in the last week and what's happened with the volatility complex and, of course, the XIV ETF being terminated after it blew up?
Sure, I can cover all that. First of all, thanks for having me. You know, this vol blow up where the VIX went from 10 to 50 did not just happen spontaneously. This all was put in motion by the rates market, by the bond market, and the fact that, you know, over the last 3 or 4 weeks, rates started to leak higher in tens and bonds. Because, quite frankly, the news that we were going to get $1 trillion in treasury issuance this year. And this was, you know, the first time since at least 20 years, it's been a really long time that supply has mattered in the treasury market. So, you know, the front end had been selling off for a while, and then the back end starts to sell off. And all of a sudden, the equity market looks at this and says, you know, we have higher rates and this is a problem. Once the sell-off got in motion, then the people who are structurally short volatility had to cover. And basically the world was short volatility. And that covering drove the VIX all the way to 50, and it blew up a couple of inverse vol ETPs, and there you have it.
And of course, we should mention that there are some of the algorithmic trading systems that are programmed when the VIX raises to start selling equities more aggressively.
Yes.
So there's kind of a self-reinforcing effect that, you know, the equity blow up causes the VIX to blow up. The VIX blow up causes the equity blow up to get worse. The equity blow up getting worse exacerbates the VIX blow up. It's all feeding on itself. Now, I think the big question that this has got to be putting in almost every investor's mind is, okay, it's pretty darn clear that although this was initiated by backing up of interest rates, I strongly agree with you on that point. One thing led to another. These two, the interplay that we've just described between the vol complex and equity markets, exacerbated the sell-off. So does that mean that we just hit the buy the dip opportunity of a lifetime because it was an artificial sell-off that went to levels that it shouldn't have? Or is it more likely the case that maybe this is just getting started because that change in rates is, you know, it's a big deal. It's going to have a continuing effect on the market, and maybe we're looking at a change in overall trend here.
I think really the change in trend, it is in the equity market, but it really isn't. It's really more about the volatility market. And if you think about how the vol market has been set up, I mean, really, it has been about 20 years since you could make money being long gamma, being long vol and dynamically hedging. It's been that long where you could really do that on a sustainable basis for a couple of years. So these short vol strategies have attracted a lot of sponsorship because they basically have a sharp ratio of infinity. I mean, if you're short S&P vol and the market realizes zero, which is basically what's been happening, then your sharp ratio is very, very high. So these strategies have been attracting a lot of sponsorship. And I can tell you that every vol desk on Wall Street, these are not long gamma traders. They have to be short gamma because that is the only trade that worked for the last 10 or 20 years. And what we've seen in the last couple of days is a regime shift in the volatility market where it will no longer pay to be short gamma. It will pay to be long gamma. If you think about what's happened just in the size of these equity moves, the Dow at one point was down 1,600 points. And then on Tuesday, there was a 1,000-point bottom-to-top swing in the Dow. If I'm thinking about this as a vol trader and I'm hearing about 1,000-point moves in the Dow, that sounds like I really want to be long gamma. And I think people are going to have to learn this the hard way. You know, I remember when I came into the option market in 1999, I heard about all the old short gamma traders from the early 90s and the mid 90s that blew up in the late 90s when volatility appeared. And we had a period of time from about 1996, 97 to 2002 when vol was very high and people had to adapt to that environment. They're going to have to adapt again.
And what is the basis? It sounds like your opinion here is this is not an anomaly that's going to mean revert and we're not headed back to, you know, VIX at 8 or something. That's over and done with, it sounds like, is what you're saying. Why are you saying that? And I guess that would probably beg the question. You know, some people might be looking at this saying, holy cow, you know, here's your opportunity right now to short the VIX, get in on that short vol trade, which has been working so well for so many years. And this is clearly a huge dislocation. Some people would be saying, if there's ever been a buy the dip of a lifetime, it's going short vol here at these higher levels. So it sounds like you think we've got a regime change that is going to be locked in for a while. Why is that? And what does it mean in terms of other implications and knock-on effects?
Honestly, it's sort of, you know, my intuition, my opinion. I mean, if you think about the significance of what happened with XIV and SVXY, right? I mean, basically, these are funds which gained in value for a period of about 6 years and then blew up. 6 years of gains gone in one day. What that means symbolically, the symbolism of that, is that the short vol trade has been discredited. And that's an explicit short vol trade. If you're long XIV, you are explicitly short vol. If you're short VIX futures or variant swaps, you're explicitly short vol. There are also implicit short vol trades too that also are going to blow up if we have a regime change. I don't really know how risk parity works really well, but it seems like an implicit short vol trade to me that is in danger. There's a lot of brokerages which market iron condor strategies to their customers. That is an explicit short vol trade. So I think they're all in danger. I think we've had a regime shift.
Jared, we had Chris Cole on the program a couple of weeks ago, and he had this pyramid slide showing that the explicit short vol trade that everybody talks about, that's the XIV ETF and the other explicit strategies, are tiny compared to the much, much larger pyramid of short vol strategies, which include risk parity that you just mentioned, but also pension overwriting and a number of other things. So, do you think that we are at a point where potentially the whole pyramid gets unwound and we're only at the beginning of this? And what would you look for if the answer is, well, it's hard to be sure yet, what would you look for to tell you whether or not we've got a major regime change in terms of where vol is headed or if this was a blip that maybe has room to mean revert?
No, I haven't seen Chris's slide, but from how you've described it, I agree with that. And I do think that this is in the beginning, the very top of the first inning, nobody out of an unwinding process that's going to take a really, really long time. And I really think it is because of the psychological significance of what just happened. People are not going to be able to put the genie back in the bottle. And I think what you have to look for is, just like any other chart person would tell you, higher lows in volatility. So if people try to stuff vol back into the teens or 13 or 12 or 11 and it doesn't work and we continue to get volatility in the stock market, then I'd say we have higher lows in vol and the trend has changed. Right now, it's a little bit too early to make that call. I'm making that call just because of my intuition, but I think you do need a little bit more evidence.
Jared, I want to focus specifically on the way the XIV blew up and the number of people that were hurt by it. Now, certainly on this program, we have been harping on this show after show after show that this short vol trade was destined to blow up someday. We're not the only ones. There's lots and lots of smart people all over the industry who have been saying this short vol thing is a disaster in the making. It's worse than picking up nickels in front of a steamroller. It's going to lead to disaster. Now, what's happened is this trade originally was something that very sophisticated institutional investors put on. And then we had the creation of these retail products like the XIV that took a strategy that lots and lots of experts in the industry were counseling strongly against as having a blow-up risk. risk that exactly this would happen. And that's well known. The people that make money on building ETFs went ahead and offered this to retail investors anyway. It seems to me, and I think Chris Cole said this in his interview, you know, this is the class action lifetime opportunity, if you're a lawyer, to look at this and say, they didn't understand. This was a product that was not appropriate for retail investors. The experts were saying it was a bad idea, and those greedy ETF inventors went ahead and offered it to retail anyway and let them be the suckers to essentially provide that source of short volatility that was really writing disaster insurance, creating cheap tail hedges for everybody else. I've got to believe this is a class action law firm's dream come true. Do you think that it's going to change the industry in terms of what kinds of products are offered? You know, we've still got triple levered ETFs and inverse double levered ETFs and all this. Do you think that what happened here is potentially going to have a serious legal risk for Credit Suisse? And do you think that it's going to change the industry in terms of other offerings of strategies in ETFs that maybe smarter people would not recommend retail investors engage in?
You know, the thing with ETFs is that you have a lot of ETFs, which are really meant as institutional products, but they have retail appeal. And XIV is one of them. It's an institutional product. You know, Joe Blow has no business shorting vol systematically, but, you know, it has a ticker. It's listed on an exchange, so he can do it. In terms of who lost money on XIV and SVXY, probably equal parts big boys and individual investors. And there's certainly a lot of people didn't know the risk. You know, once again, the SEC approved these products. They approved leveraged ETFs. I wrote a piece about leveraged ETFs on Bloomberg about a year ago about how the SEC probably regretted that it approved leveraged ETFs, and then they went and approved four times leveraged ETFs. The SEC has been very permissive about allowing these types of products to exist. Now, if you think about why does an XIV exist to begin with? Well, XIV exists because VXX exists. And VXX was everybody's dream in the mid-2000s. People wanted to securitize volatility into a product that you could trade that was listed on an exchange. People wanted a way to be long volatility without having to worry about all the other Greeks. So somebody came up with it. They listed VXX, and everybody knows what happened. It just went down relentlessly for 10 years and continues to go down. But the ETF does exactly what it's supposed to do. It does what it's supposed to do in the prospectus. And XIV was created as a reaction to that. If a long vol strategy goes down all the time because of carry, then a short vol strategy must go up all the time because of carry. Now, somebody who's a seasoned trader will know that short volatility as a strategy can give you 6 to 10 years of gains, and then you'll wipe them all out in one day. That's the nature of the trade. A lot of people didn't understand that. Are people being misled? Probably not. I think if the SEC approved the products and all the risks were disclosed in the prospectus, everything, you know, XIV and SVXY did exactly what they were supposed to do. They did not malfunction. So I struggled to see the legal basis for a lawsuit here.
Yeah, I guess to my thinking, the legal basis for the lawsuit is there's enough money involved to motivate the lawyers to make up whatever story they need to. There is so much money that got lost in one day. I agree with, you know, half of it was institutional guys, you know, should be responsible and know what they were getting into. There's a whole lot of waitresses and bartenders that somebody told, buy this thing called XIV, it can only go up, it never goes down. And they didn't do any homework, they didn't read any prospectus, they didn't do anything. And I don't think it's a question of the product not performing. I think it's more of an industry direction and policy regulation question of, you know, is it the policy and intention of SEC and other authorities to say, hey, as long as the risks are properly disclosed, if somebody doesn't read it, it's their problem? Or is it more the industry's posture that products like ETFs that are very popular with retail investors shouldn't be offered if they have risks that are difficult for a lot of retail retail investors to understand. And I think that's going to be the legal battle. And I'm sure the battle will occur just because of the amount of money that's involved, regardless of whether there's any merit to an argument or a claim against Credit Suisse. There's enough money involved that somebody's going to bring one, and we'll see what happens in the court. I think we've covered the volatility side of what's happened this week pretty thoroughly. Let's go back to equities now. Certainly, the blow-up of the volatility complex contributed to exacerbating and accelerating the downside in equities. And at least as we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon, day before this podcast will be released, the trend appears to be a bounce, at least so far. We're maybe 50% retraced so far in terms of big loss that happened earlier this week. Do you think we're headed to new highs and the market continues on? Or do you think that we're going to see a failed rally and eventually newer lows? Where do we go from here in terms of equities?
I think it's possible that we get new highs. It wouldn't really make me happy, but I think it's possible. I think that there's a parallel here to a specific day in history that I remember quite well. It was February 27th, 2007. And if you recall, you know, the stock market peaked in July of 2007, but there was a day of very serious losses, a one-day event in February. And interestingly enough, both February 27, 2007 and Monday were the highest vol of vol days in the history. So in 2007, on that day, the VIX went from 10 to 18 in one day. A very similar vol of vol type of move. And the catalyst for that particular move was China raising reserve requirements, and the ABX, which had been listed a couple months earlier, had gone down about 10 points. I mean, if you remember, the ABX was the index of subprime mortgages. And I think there's a possibility that this little vol blow up, which caused the VIX to gap from 10 to 50 in a couple of days, it might not be the actual top of the stock market, but it could be the beginning of the end. It could be a precursor to the top, and the top might be a couple of months from now. That's a possibility. Or the other possibility is that, you know, we've seen the highs and the bear market has begun, which is also possible.
Now, one thing that occurs to me just as you were speaking there, if I go back to 87, you know, a lot of people remember what I think the date was October 19th of 87 when the 23% or whatever it was in one day event happened. But really, that experience started with volatility spikes and crazy things starting to happen about a month earlier. So is there analogy here to maybe this is the tremor that comes before the big quake and the October 87 event is still a month ahead of us?
I think that is the analogy for the reasons I described earlier, that, you know, I think that this is the beginning of volatility and we're going to get more volatility. And, you know, back, you know, when I was thinking about the short vol trade, kind of like you guys were, you know, I thought to myself, where would the S&P be in the event that the vol market broke? And I thought it would be similar to 1987. I thought it would be a 20% move. Now, the vol market didn't break. It actually functioned properly. It was just a giant dislocation. But I still think that the volatility is really ahead of us.
We've talked about volatility and we've talked about equities and what's happened here. But as you said earlier, what brought this all on was really a backing up in interest rates. So, you know, we've had Jeff Gundlach and several other notable people kind of make a declaration saying, okay, guys, this is it. 35-year bond bull market is over. We're headed towards much higher treasury rates. And I guess the thing that I would have asked before this week is I would have said, wait a minute, I don't see how that's possible because I think, first of all, you run the risk of crashing the equity market. And second of all, at some point, if you try to get back to historically normal rates, the U.S. government can't possibly, you know, we used to have 7-8% treasury rates, but we didn't have a $20 trillion national debt at that time. There's no way the U.S. government can service its debt at what we think of as historically normal interest rates. So I kind of think in terms of how much farther can this increase in rates go before it causes big problems. And it seems like this week may have been the first of those problems. Would you agree with that? And how far can it go? And what's driving it? And do you think it's going to continue?
I think a lot of people sort of lose track of the fact that the bond market is dictated by supply and demand like any other market. It just doesn't seem like that all the time. Right now, we have the prospect of a lot of supply. I mean, the bond market, honestly, is a mess. It's an absolute mess right now as we speak, considering that we dropped on an intraday basis in the stock market 6% and the bond market can't get out of its own way is not really a good sign. Having said that, you know, I think the time to get bearish on the bond market was when 10s were at 1.6, not when they're at 2.6. That's a pretty big move. And I think that there's a limit as to how high yields can go if you think that a recession is coming sooner rather than later. Having said all that, you know, you could make the argument that just on a valuation basis that the bond market and the stock market have been overvalued simultaneously and that both of them could decline at the same time. And that's exactly what's happening.
Let's assume that that is what's happening. I think there's a very strong probability that it is. A lot of really smart people have opined in the last several years. You know, people are worried about stock market crashes, but boy, if you see a popping of a bubble in the bond market, that's where you really talk about major, major consequences in terms of the global economy. Are we potentially at the beginning of something that could escalate into a bond market crisis? Or is this just kind of a warning sign that maybe the market's going to correct? And what would you expect? I mean, obviously, we could, you know, resort to more quantitative easing and buy up this excess supply of bonds in order to contain rates. That has not been the policy direction that's been announced, and everybody would like us to believe we're moving away from those kind of policies. Do you think at some point policymakers would be forced to make a U-turn and go back to accommodative monetary policy in order to prevent rates from running away?
I think that we can sustain a lot more pain in the bond market before people start thinking of that kind of stuff. I mean, even, you know, so today, like, 10s are at 270, 280. 30-year fixed mortgages are around 4.25, 4.5%. I mean, still really, really low. Like, nobody's experiencing any pain because mortgages went from 3.5 to 4.5. I mean, you really have to get mortgage rates up to 6 before that starts making a difference. Same thing with treasury debt. You know, I think that the interest expense has to go up by a couple hundred billion dollars in order for people to start thinking about what can we do to get interest rates lower. And keep in mind that the Treasury, you know, under Obama actually did a pretty good job of extending the duration of its maturities. You know, so I think we used to be at about a 3.5 year duration in the bond market. And now I think we're at about 6 or 7. So, you know, and Mnuchin, when he was first named Treasury Secretary, wanted to issue 50s and 100s to extend the duration even more. So I think the Treasury has actually done a pretty good job of setting us up so we're not entirely dependent on short term funding.
Jared, let's move on to the U.S. dollar. Something that's perplexed me for the last several weeks is, hey, in many ways, it looked like the dollar was headed lower, but at the same time, treasuries are headed higher. That's not the usual relationship. What's going on here, and where do you see the dollar headed from here?
I actually teach at a university. I teach finance, and whenever I talked about FX, we would spend, you know, we would do a whole chapter on FX, and the first thing I would say is 80% of currency movements are explained by interest rates. And look, I'm a pretty good FX trader, and I made a living literally for the last 8 to 10 years of following central bank policy, predicting changes in direction, and trading FX off of it. And for the last 6 to 12 months, really the last 6 months, interest rates have had nothing to do with it. And you have the weakness in the dollar has been persistent and totally unexplained. And I don't have an answer to your question. I can't say, well, it's because of Trump or it's because of, you know, trade or it's because of who knows. But it's been really hard to trade FX in this environment. I mean, especially if you look at the euro. I mean, you know, I started getting bullish on the euro a while back because I thought that they would taper asset purchases, and I thought that they would eventually raise interest rates. I thought it would take them a while. You know, here we are about a year, year and a half later, and they haven't done anything. And, you know, we're pricing in still, even with the downturn in the markets, we're still pricing in three hikes this year. The dollar should be a lot stronger, and I just don't have an answer. It's really perplexing to me.
I want to follow on that and just see if you are as perplexed as I am by the relationship also to gold here, because the way I look at this, everything you just said, spot on. I couldn't agree more. And the one exception I might say is, hey, if you wanted an explanation for how could the dollar be going down in the face of these rates, the answer would be, well, this is the kind of thing that you see not in developed markets, but in emerging markets. And what it means is that we're starting to see a loss of faith globally in the United States and in the U.S. dollar as the hegemonic currency that drives the world. And, you know, the Shanghai Futures Exchange yuan-denominated oil contract is evidence of this. And what it means is the dollar is falling from prominence and therefore is headed down even though rates are headed higher. Now, I didn't think something like that was going to happen for several more years, but I do think it's plausible. The thing is, if that was it, I would think gold would be just to the moon. And, you know, we're seeing gold roll over here. Am I right to think that the action in gold kind of rules out that explanation, or am I missing something?
I think gold has kind of done okay. I think what you might be missing is, believe it or not, I'm a France bull. I might be the only France bull in the world. And I was very vocal about the French elections. And first at the possibility that François Fillon might win, I was excited about him. And I was also excited about Macron. And Macron has turned out to be a free market reformer. He is reforming a lot of the French economic system. And he, by getting elected, has made Europe stronger. So I think relative to Europe, gold maybe necessarily isn't going up because there's actually a currency that's a counterbalance to the U.S. And even though the ECB isn't doing anything, I would offer that as an explanation as to why that exchange rate is where it is.
Jared, let's move on to another subject you've written quite about, which is Canada. Canadian equity market, Canadian housing, these are fascinating topics. We've heard a few different opinions in the program. What's going on with the Canadian economy, and how do you interpret the actions that you've seen both in equities and housing in Canada?
Well, most people have some understanding that Canada has a housing bubble. There's just no two ways about it. They have a housing bubble. The levels of personal debt in Canada are the highest in the world. The average home price is $500,000 in Canada. That's the average. And, you know, the central bank, Palaz, is sort of in a position where he's stuck. You know, the economy has been strong. They've been printing 4% GDP, but it's very hard for him to raise interest rates because most people in Canada have an adjustable rate mortgage, and those adjustable rate mortgages are indexed to 5-year notes in Canada, and yields on fives have gone from 80 basis points to over 2%. So there's been a huge tightening in Canada. The BOC has hiked rates 3 times since the summer, and I think they're stuck. You know, Palaza said that they're probably not going to hike anymore. They've been following the U.S. They've hiked 3 times. We've hiked 3 times. And honestly, I think they're done. I think that the housing market is pretty close to the downturn that everybody's been waiting for the last couple of years. Home sales just came out in Toronto. They were down 22% year over year. So you're starting to see some of that crappy data.
And do you think that there is a potential that the money coming in from outside the country, I wonder, you know, on the one hand, they've gone out of their way to intentionally impose these taxes on foreign transactions. But if the market starts to crash and they need to rescue it, I wonder if somebody will say, hey, that was a mistake. We need to de-restrict these. And if that were to happen, do you think there's a chance that that saves the market? Or is it just too big that once the avalanche starts, nothing can stop it?
Well, I think most of that foreign money was coming from China. And, you know, since those foreign buyers taxes were imposed in Vancouver and Toronto, China has been pretty successful at imposing capital controls. So a lot less of that money is finding its way to Canada. So I think even if they were to reverse those foreign buyers taxes, it's a little bit too late. You're just not going to see that flood of money coming from China anymore.
Well, Jared, I want to thank you for a fantastic interview. Before we go, though, please tell our listeners about the Daily Dirt Nap and what you do there.
Sure. Well, first of all, if I write a lot of free stuff for Malden Economics, if you want to read me for free and test it out, go to maldeneconomics.com and check out the 10th Man. But my paid newsletter service is called the Daily Dirt Nap, and you can go to www.dailydirtnap.com.
Jared, thank you so much for an excellent interview. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back, and be sure to stay tuned, folks, because Devin Anderson will be joining us in the postgame segment, where we're going to come back and talk a little bit more about the blow-up that occurred in the volatility complex this week.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Jared Dillon. I want to move on, though, to our post-game guests. We brought back Chris Cole to join us to give us an update on what was going on. And obviously, now, Chris, the timing of having you on the show was just perfect. We came on and you talked about all of the risks associated with these short vol trades. And just 2 weeks later, we're seeing it all unraveling. We wanted to bring you back to kind of get a post-mortem as to how this all played out. First of all, welcome back on the show.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you very much.
No problem. And just wanted to get your idea on how did this all play out from your perspective?
In my letter in October, and actually if you go even further back, actually if you go back to some of the comments I said to Izzy Kaminska back in 2014 and then my letter in 2015, you know, I talked about the unraveling of the explicit shortfall trade, particularly the VIX ETPs. And to recap, even just a week ago on the show, I called these a class action lawsuit waiting to happen. It was not if, but when. And I think the only thing that surprised me about their true unraveling was how fast it really was. That's the only thing that really shocked me, just in a blink of an eye, how it was over. That after-hours session on Monday, where you just saw liquidity vanish in the VIX futures space, it's exactly what occurred or what was prophesized and talked about in the letter in October, but it was just amazing to watch and surreal to watch. Everyone talks, congratulations, about calling this. Well, I don't think what I've really talked about has come to pass yet. You know, the VIX ETPs are the smallest portion of the global shortfall trade. Talk about this idea of about $1.5 to $2 trillion worth of shortfall exposure, both explicit and implicit. Explicit short volatility are VIX exchange-traded products and vol overriding funds. You know, the VIX ETPs are only $5 billion, right? You have $1.5 trillion of implicit short volatility strategies, strategies that may not be directly shorting options, but have the use financial engineering to mimic the components of a short option portfolio. There's about $1.5 trillion worth of these of exposure. This is what we're seeing come online now. This is the real risk. So stocks and bonds sell off together. You have disorderly unwind, withdrawal of liquidity, and then all of a sudden volatility, increasing volatility results in a quick deleveraging of these implicit short volatility strategies. And this will drive the next leg of the crisis. So I think, you know, people say, congratulations, you called the short vol trade. No, nothing has happened yet. This is an appetizer. This is just the appetizer for the unwind that is about to come. And I think this is what people should be really afraid of. And I think this is the next leg of this that we will see. Whether this happens in 2 weeks or whether this happens over 2 years, I don't know. But I strongly believe this will come to pass, and it will be quite disorderly and ugly.
I want to refer our listeners to the presentation that you did for us 2 weeks ago. You can still, if you're a registered user at macrovoices.com, log into the website, go to the research library area of the website. Under guest downloads, you can find Chris's PowerPoint presentation. And there is one slide in particular, it's a pyramid, that shows that what blew up this week, which is the explicit short vol trades through things like the XIV ETF, is like this tiny little top of the pyramid triangle. And there's a mountain of implicit short vol below that. And the thing that really hit me as I was thinking about this week, Chris, is the next thing down, as I remember it, in that pyramid was the risk parity, which is just such a popular strategy. I don't know how many gazillion dollars are in risk parity strategies. If we suddenly have the stock market selling off because of higher bond yields, that means stock market and bond market selling off at the same time, which the risk parity crowd thought would never happen. We're seeing that correlation between stocks and bonds change. And at the same time, it's unwinding that next level in your pyramid. It sounds to me like that sets up a really, really ugly feedback loop. Am I correct to interpret it that way? And I guess particularly, what would be the signposts that we should be looking for to tell us when, you know, we knew what to look for in this VIX trade. It was the VIX shooting up and the ETFs blowing up, or I should say the ETNs blowing up the way they did. What do we want to be looking for? Is it just risk parity panic and everybody bailing out of that strategy? Are there other things we should be watching for? And what comes next after that?
You know, as I talk about in Volatility and the Alchemy of Risk, this is a snake eating itself. The snake has been eating its own tail. Lower volatility begets lower volatility. But the reverse can happen, where higher volatility begets higher volatility in a doom spiral. So what we saw happen with VIX futures is really about to happen with the entire equity market. Because it's not just risk parity, but you have risk parity, which is a, you know, short gamma, short correlation, short interest rate strategy. You have vol control funds, which are a short volatility, short gamma strategy. You have risk premia strategies. This is $1.5 trillion worth of implicit short vol exposure that unwinds and uses volatility and stability as an input to unwind their portfolios. And this unwind occurs nonlinearly. So now that volatility increases, I think the warning posts really are some of the signs we're even starting to see is a quick withdrawal in liquidity, simultaneous declines in stocks and bonds, wild gyrations in cross assets and correlation breakdowns, and then finally deteriorating credit conditions. And this is where we enter into this reflexive spiral where now higher volatility begets higher volatility in a doom loop. It's really driven, weirdly and ironically, it's driven by the thing the Fed has been trying to create the last number of years, which is inflation. You know, you start to have some element of potential reflation, and the withdrawal of stimulus because of that anticipated inflation, and this is what leads to this spiral of higher vol. And back in 87, portfolio insurance was 2% of the market. Today, these strategies potentially are upwards of 10%. So what we saw with VIX futures is just the appetizer to a much more dangerous unwind. The timing, you know, it's impossible to call that, but I think we'll see it either in 2 weeks or within 2 years.
Chris, unfortunately, we need to leave it there in the interest of time because we've still got to get Devin Anderson on the program to follow up on his comments from several weeks back. Before we go, you know, I think some people were confused when we had you on 2 weeks ago. You mentioned what you and I know is a very common lingo in the hedge fund business, which is you're getting ready to soft close your fund, meaning it has seen so much interest that you can only accept so much assets under management before you come capacity limited. And you are close to the point where you're obviously going to continue operating your hedge fund because you have a fantastic strategy, which needless to say has profited extremely well from your anticipating this event. For the accredited investors who are able to invest in hedge funds, they're going to need to move quickly because you're almost at your AUM target and about to close the fund to new investors. How do the accredited investors contact you if they want to find out more about your offerings?
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. Absolutely correct. What I meant to say is we're soft closing. We have a AUM limitation, and we're going to abide by that. We conservatively anticipate that that will be hit by the end of this quarter. But for those who are still interested, we do have accredited investors can just contact us at info@artemiscm.com through our website. And those who are accredited, the fund is still open, is still running, and we're not shutting it. It's just being closed to new investors by the end of the first quarter, we anticipate.
And for anyone who is not familiar with this, I'll just add that this is a very, very common phenomenon in the hedge fund industry. The very best funds tend to be capacity limited and get closed. So if you are interested in this strategy, move quickly, because needless to say, recent events are going to create a spike in interest in this strategy. Chris, I really want to get you back on the program. I think we need to do a much more in-depth follow-up in a full-length interview, but let's give the market a little bit of time to play out and see where this thing goes. We'll get you back on the program at some point to do a follow-up and talk about the bigger picture of how the rest of this unwind is going to look for the implicit short vol aspects of that big pyramid of risk that you showed us 2 weeks ago.
It's been a pleasure to be here, and say hi to Devin for me. He's a really smart guy.
Now, Chris, thank you so much for joining us. So now moving on to the second guest we have for our post game is Devin Anderson, the managing director of a derivatives desk at a bulge bracket firm. Thank you for joining us, Devin.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Devin, you were on our show back on November 30th, and we were talking about the very circumstances of what would happen if this vol trade was to blow up and what kind of circumstance would have to lead to it. And you were suggesting that we'd have to have a one-day move of even north of 7%. But really, it played out a little bit differently. Why don't you give us a quick postmortem of how Monday played out and what are your thoughts on how everything ended up transpiring?
Yeah, so the ETPs, XIV and SVXY, are effectively gone at this point. They massively de-risk on Monday as the consequence of the rebalance. But the market started selling off on Friday after advanced hourly earnings kicked off some fear of higher rates and higher inflation expectations, and that carried through to Monday. Then Monday afternoon, spot and the S&P really started selling off and accelerating. And vols were up. The weighted average of VIX future that underlies those ETPs was up 5 to 6 points through almost into the close, then began to accelerate with spot, you know, off 3-ish%. Spot began to accelerate kind of at the heights after market, which is where about half of the move occurred. The spot was off 5-6%. And the ETPs closed within 4% of their original AUM. So let me explain what that means. On Friday, the underlying VIX futures level, so the, you know, you can think of it as the underlying for the ETPs, closed at 1520. On Monday, it went from 1520 to 1980. So the ETPs lost 96% of their value. So those things are designed to be the inverse performance of the VXX, which is long volatility. VXX went up 96%. These things went down 96%. And about half of that move occurred between 405 and 415. So that was against, you know, that whole situation and the acceleration of the bid for vol occurred a little faster than I thought it would. I really thought, based on the historical beta of S&P spot to the VIX, to the VIX futures, that it would have taken a bigger spot move. You know, but I think kind of one of the things that has changed is that there's been so much education and so much attention to this story over time that people were pretty prepared to try and trade in front of this, right? And that's what accounts for the fact that, you know, essentially half of the move of the VIX futures that day occurred between 405 and 415 ahead of the, these things close at 415, ahead of the 415 level, because folks just knew that there was going to have to be a big covering of the short from the levered ETP complex. So it was a smaller move than I thought, but I also want to point out that, you know, we've been telling clients, I mean, you talk about catching a javelin. The difference between them closing with 4% of their equity left and none is the difference between 29.80 in the closing futures level and 30 spot six. Like, they were almost there, almost negative equity. The last time I was on the show, we spent a bunch of time talking about, well, what would happen if either the XIV, the note, or SVXY, the ETF, finished in a situation where there was negative equity. And that almost happened on, you know, on like a 5-ish% after hours total move, and vol almost doubled, and then it kind of reverted small. Since then, though, the action has been pretty interesting. So there's been a sustained bid to the February VIX future, kind of well in excess of what we would expect for this absolute level of implied. And while spot in the S&P reverted, it gave back about half of its move. You know, today's Thursday the 8th. In the afternoon, this set the sell-off and spot accelerated again. And now, like, our five-day total return in the S&P is down about 8%. So now we're really at this junction where I think we have to be careful about the other short vol strategies that we talked about beginning to come into play, along with the vol control, but less so risk parity. We can talk about that. You know, there is a point where these things begin to feed on one another, and, you know, I'm a little afraid we're starting to get there, and I would not have said that even a day ago. This additional 3-ish% sell-off in spot today is starting, along with a sustained bid for the February VIX future, is beginning to convince me that, you know, there's more risk out here, you know, as soon as the next few days than I might have initially anticipated. At the end of Tuesday, we thought that this blow up in the VIX futures was going to be isolated pretty specifically just to equities. And we were getting a lot of client questions that they didn't even understand what was going on, because in their asset class or their region of the world, it didn't look like that big of a deal. It was just a very U.S. equity centric story. But now with spot down 8% or so, I'm beginning to get a little bit more worried.
Devin, one of the narratives that's been floating around this week is people are saying, you know, it's not the case that the equity market blew up and that blew up the vol complex. What they're saying, and I don't know what they're basing this on, I'm hoping you can debunk it or tell me if it's true, is that really what happened is a fairly modest move in equities, in the equity spot price, led to that panic point in the VIX, because so many people have been talking about this short vol trade, the explicit short vol trade through the ETPs like XIV and SVXY. That led to the blow up in futures, and it was actually the VIX futures that were essentially being short squeezed by people panicking out of these ETPs that caused the algos to react and start selling equities aggressively, and that's where the sell-off came from. Is there any truth to that story, or is that just urban legend that we're hearing?
I don't think there's an algo interaction. All of these things are related to one another, but it's not because of algos. I think it's because of human behavior. Let me talk about why I think that's true. So the ETP universe blows up. And by the way, I should mention, if we were to envision all of the possible ways that the VIX ETPs could have de-risked, this is about the most benign one. Right. This is, you know, to make an interest rate analogy, I mean, this is about the softest landing possible. There was a steady bid for the futures all day that accelerated after market, which I think is a time when a lot of people aren't paying attention. They knocked out without developing a negative equity. And then over the next 2 days and up until this afternoon, when the spot sell-off began to reignite, things were beginning to look like they would normalize. So the question is, why has there been this weird bid for front month volatility, and why did we have another 3-ish% sell-off today? I don't think that that's because of algos. I think it's because there are plenty of clients and there are plenty of professional asset managers out there that use value at risk-based metrics to measure their risk. And a lot of those value at risk-based metrics take in inputs of implied volatility or realized volatility to develop essentially their distribution of outcomes. So the way VAR works is it says, I'm going to take all the positions in my portfolio, and then I'm going to develop a distribution to say, well, you know, probability adjusted, what could happen to that particular portfolio? Well, the width of that distribution is, of course, volatility. And if what you use as an input, with what you use to inform the width of that distribution is implied or realized volatility, well, we're in kind of a unique situation whereby the thing that blew up on Monday were products directly tied to your measurement, right? So I think if you're trailing along at a 12 to 14 realized vol, you throw a 2.6% move close to close the move in the S&P, I want to say, was a little more than 4%. Yeah, 4.1%. Now, all of a sudden, 10-day realized vol is 28, right, and 30-day realized vol is 18. So on a percentage basis, that's a really big change. And the implied vols, because that's specifically where the squeeze was from the VIX ETPs, you know, we're up 100% on Monday, right? And so that's since reverted a little bit. But my point is, any kind of metric you could have pulled about an expectation of market volatility, whether it's realized or implied, and turn around and stuck in your value at risk model, on Tuesday, you came in and all of a sudden you had way more implied market risk than you did the day before, even if you didn't do a single trade on Monday. So people then react to that and have to de-risk. I think that's why that's at least partially why there's been a sustained bid for the February VIX future relative to the March. There's why there's been a sustained bid for the weekly S&P options and the March S&P options, and why we've seen a little bit of this dislocation because, you know, one, people are going to have to de-risk a little bit in response to their increased VAR metrics. And two, there's going to be less supply of options coming into the market because if you're being told to de-risk, you're certainly not selling anything and there's less sellers of vol around. Now, I don't want my comments to be extrapolated into I think that there's a giant VAR shock coming, right? People throw that phrase around and it tends to incite riots. I don't mean that at all, but I do think that there has been an increase to most folks' VAR metrics, and that's what's now showing up both in the supply of volatility to the market and this, what I think is rebalance flow from investors happening at the end of the day.
Let's talk a little bit about where markets are likely to go from here, because it seems to me that if I ask myself, why is it that we have had this just steady, very, very solid equity bull market here? Well, with just incredibly generationally low vol, that means that tail hedges are super cheap. So the argument to lever up your long equity strategy, protect yourself with puts, those puts were just, you know, pennies on what you're used to paying for them. Why not? Well, the answer to why not now is because it ain't cheap anymore. So does that kind of put a lid on the structural ability of this market? The really big question is, are we seeing the beginning of that big event that really creates a secular change in direction for equity markets? Or is this a blip we need to get through before we end up eventually getting through it and powering on to even new all-time highs in the stock market?
Right. So I think there's good paths from here and there's bad paths from here. And it all depends on speed. So I'm very sympathetic to the observation that a critical driver of both the bid to equities and the very low realized vol has been the process of asset substitution generated from low rates. So this is something I talked about last time. People go up the securities market line and take more risk when vol is low because they need the returns. So to some extent, this vol regime is going to end by the reversal of that process, and it's very much a question of how quickly that process runs in reverse, just as it ran forward for the last few years. I think that, you know, starting from here, there's good ways that it goes and there's bad ways that it goes, and all the good ways involves that process running slowly in reverse, and the bad ways that it go revolve around that process running quickly in reverse. So the bad ones are a little bit more exciting, so let's start there. Like we talked about last time, the VIX ETPs are really only one way that people sell vol. There are other ways. There is a big, very big community of people that sell outright puts and condors. That stuff sold out of private banks, kind of into the RIA community and to clients of that private bank, either from the strategy manager in the bank or from an overlay provider that's external that markets directly to retail. Those guys are pretty big and they sell out of the money options and they have an exposure directly to the total return of the market kind of in short periods because they sell mostly 6 to 8 week options. I would say that, you know, somewhere around 10% in like 3 weeks is a down 10% move in 3 weeks is where that stuff is probably going to start to get sensitive. And that's just kind of my guess based on the types of strategies that we know that they employ. Then there's a whole group of institutional asset managers that are selling options via variant swaps and delta hedge straddles and kind of what I would say more sophisticated strategies that require more maintenance. But, you know, all of this stuff together can form a feedback loop with other short gamma strategies. So I know you had Chris Cole on. You know, Chris and I spent a lot of time talking. So I'm sure he talked about the embedded short gamma and other strategies like vol control and risk parity. So let me talk about those quickly, and then I'll try to tie it all together. Vol control is an interesting phenomenon whereby mostly insurance companies ask asset managers to give them the return of an asset, but with a mandated target vol. So the insurance company goes to the asset manager and they say, okay, well, I want you to give me the S&P, but I want the S&P on a target vol of 10. So that means if they asked for $10 million worth of exposure and trailing realized vol was 10, the asset manager would have $10 million of exposure. If trailing realized vol was 15, they would delever by 50%, right? Just the ratio of those two things. If trailing realized vol was 5, they would lever up. They would lever up to $15 million to $20 million or some cap if there was a cap involved. Sometimes these things are capped. But the point is the exposure of that mandate goes up and down with respect to the level of trailing realized vol. So as realized vol goes up, they have futures to sell because they have to make their mandate smaller because their bogey is to hit this target that they've been given. And if the market is more volatile, they just have to own less of it. That's how target vol mandates work. So that's a mandated trading that occurs in response to the price action of the market. And that is exactly what a short gamma profile is, but it's not coming explicitly from an option. That's a lot different than the risk parity world. Risk parity is a portfolio construction method that says, I'm going to take a bunch of assets and scale them to a similar vol, and then I'm going to weight according to, you know, what I think my fundamental and technical views are. That community is extremely slow acting. So it's not like the market sold off, you know, just about 3% today. It's not like those managers are recalculating their Sharpe ratios and correlation matrices, resolving for their portfolio to trade tomorrow. And it just doesn't work like that. These folks rebalance on 2-week to 8-week type time horizon, and their reaction function would have them trading in a 2 to 8 week type window. Where I differ a lot from the rest of the community is that on a big enough move, the risk control world absolutely is going to have some stuff to sell. But the risk parity world, barring a catastrophe where the market sells off 20% in a day, I actually don't think is that meaningful of an exposure. And, you know, and actually kind of on that comment, Cliff Asness from AQR put out a note, a public note last night that he titled kind of rather humorously, risk parity derangement syndrome. So I don't share people's concerns about risk parity. I do share the concerns about vol control. And the way that stuff can all begin to act together is you get a market where things are down around 10% inside of two weeks to 3 weeks, and it looks like it's accelerating. And then the fundamental guys come in and start selling just simply because they have to de-risk because the market's down. You get the quant factor start to look a little poor, like low beta is selling off and value is selling off. And then you add on top of that, the vol control guys show up with another, you know, and I want to say, like for every 3% move, another $9 billion or so for sale. And all of this stuff can start to run in a loop, right? And as of the close today, you know, we're down about 8% in 5 days. So like we're starting to creep towards the point where I would start to get worried where these feedback loops could actually develop and interact with one another. But it's all about acceleration. If we accelerate from here, I think it'd get fairly ugly. If we come in tomorrow and things are up 2% and then time passes, which is the critical part, because as time passes, these things restrike and the risk becomes diffuse over new and different strikes. So it's all about speed, right? An accelerated move down here, and I'm really worried. And up until this afternoon, I actually thought we were on the good path where things looked like they were starting to normalize, except for the front end of the vol curve. But it actually looks a little bit more like bot in the rest of the market, and to some extent yields are coming around to the elevated vols rather than the elevated vols coming around to a retracement that we had previously seen in spot.
So to summarize, if I'm reading your view correctly, what you're really telling us is there's still just barely room for this to all blow over. We could see a resolution where, hey, you know, the blow up of the explicit short vol complex caused a great big temporary panic, but we got through it and we're recovering. But we need to see that recovery. If we don't see that recovery and the weather does not clear from here, then we could be looking at a perfect storm scenario potentially developing. And the real thing to watch for is acceleration on the downside.
I don't think there's any outcome where we go back to a trailing realized vol of 6. I don't think that's happening. I think that the VIX ETP situation has caused people to reevaluate their risk profile, either qualitatively because the market sold off and vols went up a lot, or quantitatively because they have a value at risk-based risk system that is now signaling that their portfolio suddenly became riskier. And the way that that works itself off is time passing, right? So a continued move quickly possibly ignites these things into a feedback loop. Time passing lets all of these risks diffuse. You know, from here, at the end of the day on Thursday the 8th, I think it's fairly tough to tell which one is going to happen. I certainly am not rooting for a meltdown, I can tell you that. But I absolutely think there's a window where either one could happen safely. And it was a positive outcome that the VIX ETPs delevered fully on Monday without negative equity, right? I mean, that's a really welcome development. But I do think that that changed things with respect to the volatility regime. We're not going back to six. I think we're probably going back to a world where trailing realized vol over most time horizons is something like, you know, 14 or 15, and implied vols are something like 15 to 17. Like, I think that's probably our new normal rather than the ultra low world that we were in. You know, and again, as long as we don't accelerate.
Now, it seems to me that in terms of the big picture, the regime that we've had until now is one where shorting vol is a super duper popular strategy. And that's basically supplying the market with a huge supply of cheap optionality. Does this really mean that we're entering a new regime where, you know, there's a self-reinforcing process here? As you said, we're not going back to trailing six implied. It seems to me that there's not going to be a whole lot of people rushing back in to fund the launch of the next ETN that replaces XIV because they can't wait to get back into this just wonderful strategy of shorting vol. So does this mean that systemically we have much less supply of vol than we used to have and it's going to stay that way for a long time?
Well, I think that there is going to be less supply because the ETPs are smaller. Although that said, they have had a few hundred million dollars worth of inflows post-Monday already. I think there's going to be less interest in that and in doing it. When you see something go down 96% in a single day, I think it makes people reevaluate their sizing, right? And what I would generally say about short vol is that there's nothing wrong with short vol. I think the people that say that, you know, you just never should have a short vol strategy, you know, are trying to make a safety statement for everyone. But I think the more complete statement is you need to have a properly sized short vol strategy. And the thing about it is that the proper size is never really the size that you want. Right? People want to make a lot of money from them, but in all the cases where you make a lot of money from those shortfall strategies, those are also the cases where you're probably taking too much tail risk. So I think properly sized allocation to these things is appropriate for many different types of investors. But people get out over their skis on their allocations to this because it starts to feel like easy money. And if it feels like easy money for a long enough time, the allocations get too big. And that, unfortunately, has probably happened. So I think these things, like I say, losing 96% of face in one day is going to make people reevaluate their sizing. And that's probably a healthy thing. But I also think the first order drivers of vol in financial markets are not these dynamics. These dynamics matter on the margin, of course. But the volatility around our expectations for inflation, specifically inflation, that's what started this whole thing last Friday, and our expectations for volatility around growth and GDP are also going up. And those are really the first principal drivers. Those are the things that really underpin what makes volatility, because those are the things that really change people's view about growth. And, you know, people's differing view about growth makes people buy and sell stocks, and vol is price movement. So the thing that matters the most is that on the margin, weird things can happen because of financial products for sure. But I just think we're entering a new regime where there's going to be, to your point, there is going to be less vol selling. It's not going away. I mean, let's keep in mind that despite the volatility and increase in interest rates, you know, the 10-year is still 282. Right? That's not a sell stocks and buy that and replace it with the 10-year and retire level just yet, right? So there's still going to be interest in carry strategies. The question is, can you design them in such a way that you're taking a little less tail risk? Something we spend a lot of time talking to clients about. But as far as the regime goes, fundamental factors are picking up, less sellers, and that's going to lead to a higher base for realized, which underpins the whole volatility complex.
You've talked about acceleration to the downside being the biggest thing to watch for in terms of a warning signal. Is a continued increase in treasury rates another warning signal, just because it seems like that intolerance of higher yields is what started this? Or do you think that that's not necessarily a risk factor?
I think it can be. I think the long-term driver that will take us from one regime to another is the process of asset substitution unwinding, right? The people that went up the securities market line and took more risk will come back down as they get the same yield for a lower volatility, or from a lower volatility asset. Again, it's just a question of speed, right? A very quickly increasing interest rate moves people down the curve faster, right? And that takes up liquidity and can create shocks. So I think it all depends on the path of how things go up. If this process of substitution runs quickly, we're going to have a more volatile market. If it runs less slowly, we're going to have a slightly more volatile market, but probably not one at an increasing rate.
Well, Devin, I really appreciate you coming back on the program. Your insights are fantastic with the exposure that you have there running a derivatives desk for one of the major firms on the street. So we really appreciate your input. Folks, we obviously need to wrap it there in the interest of time this week, but we do need your help promoting the show. Where else are you going to hear three guests in 1 week on a week like this than Macro Voices? So please tell your friends and colleagues, forward your research roundup emails, and most importantly, register your free account at macrovoices.com, because the more registered users we have, the more able Patrick is to negotiate to get the very best feature interview guests on the program. The benefit to you is you'll receive our free research roundup email each week, which never contains any advertising or marketing. It's just a compendium of links to all of the coolest free stuff that we could find on the internet. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
You're going to find the transcript for today's interview with Jared, as well as a number of the issues he provided for our listeners to be able to read of the Daily Dirt Nap newsletter. You'll also find a link to Eric's appearance on HedgeEye, where him and Keith McCullough discuss Bitcoin as the biggest speculative mania in history. You'll also find a link to an article talking about Gundlach suggesting that the market unwind will be turbulent and not just a few days. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. Now, if you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.